I got ran over twice. I had knives pulled on me, a gun pointed at me, petrol poured on me, I was threatened to be set alight. You know, some days you can be earning 500-600 quid a day doing that. We collected anything from a couple hundred quid to a couple of hundred thousand. The flip side of that is you could be turning up at a scrapyard in Birmingham that are going to set the dogs on you.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, personally, I used to hate scrapyards and gyms. You know, I know three lads in the last 2 years who are all in the trades who have taken their own lives. Out of anyone that takes their own life, 75% of that is men. It's the biggest killer of men under 50. If you're in the building trades, you are four times more likely to take your own life as a man than being in another industry. Through working at Samaritans, I realised the power of a conversation, the power of just listening.
Right then, another episode. Trade Legend Podcast, Series 6. We're not doing episodes anymore because no one knows really where we're at. And continuity-wise, it could end in tears with Jack, couldn't it? So, tonight we've got Arne Russell, the Talking Tradesman Podcast, and also, what is it?
RDP Painters and Decorators.
RDP Painters and Decorators, yeah. Based out of...
So we cover the whole of the Midlands in terms of decorating. The podcast, obviously, is national, but our little humble studios in Stourport.
Nice. And we've also got Sam Draycott. Yep. And what's your company, Sam?
So it's just Sam Draycott Farrier.
Farrier, and you're based out of?
Surrey.
So we've got a farrier on and a painter and decorator on.
Indeed.
Farrier, I think it's probably one of the most out there trades we've had so far. We've had a Thatcher on. Have we had the Thatcher on yet? We haven't yet, have we? It's booked in. So we've got a Thatcher on. So yeah, so you are. You're top of the list. So what we try and do on the podcast is sort of take it back a little bit, how you got into your trade, a bit of an insight into what made you get into that trade and just your journey to where you are at the minute. Just covering a little backstory. So who wants to go first? Either or? We'll start with you then, Russ.
Flip a coin. Yeah, no, I'm happy to. So when people ask me that question, I often joke that I was born with a paintbrush in my hand. So I'm third generation.
All right.
So my granddad set the business up back in the 60s. My dad's also a decorator. So yeah, it was like family for me. I would say like I first started going to work with my dad when I was about 8.
Right.
You know,
summer holidays.
My mum and dad split up when I was young and I stayed with my dad. So my options were I could go to work and sit and read magazines because iPads and that didn't exist. So
how old are you, Russ?
39.
Right, okay. So that would have been, what, early 80s? Born early 80s. So, it'd be
so
early
90s. Early 90s. So the best I had was like magazines, 442 magazine, something like that.
Yeah.
So I could read that back to front, but then my dad would turn around to me and go, oh, look, you know, if you want to strip some wallpaper, and that was how it started, right. Do a bit of prep work, I'll pay you whatever it was, £5-10 a day.
Yeah.
So I started that way, worked with him all the like school holidays that came along. And then I got to the point, I guess, when I left school, I was adamant there was no chance I was going to be a decorator.
Was you sort of quite academic at school?
Yeah, I did all right at school.
You did all right, okay.
I did all right, yeah. So I
sound really surprising. You get a lot of tradespeople.
You
said a lot of tradespeople don't tend to do, 90% of tradespeople are like, done crap at school, just wanted to get out there,
No, so. I did okay. I did all right through my GCSEs, started doing my A-levels, did the first year of my A-level. I was the first year through school when they split it. So I don't know what it is now, but it used to be like an A-level was a two-year thing. You did an exam at the end. Yeah. And then I was the first year where they split it to an AS and then an A2. So I did my AS levels and then got kicked out of school.
Right.
So I didn't finish them.
What did you get kicked out
for? I just got asked politely to not come back, basically. So
I think it's kind of my life story. That's exactly what happened to me.
Do you know what? I remember I went to get my exam results, my AS level results, and my year head was waiting like at the top of the stairs to the school, and she just pulled me to the side and went, "You've done remarkably well in your exams," with surprise all over her face.
Right.
And she went, "But if you'd like to finish your A levels, please do it elsewhere."
No way.
Wow. So,
really?
Yeah.
And you did well?
Yeah, I've done all right. Yeah,
yeah, usually they would keep you, don't they?
I did terrible. And they were like, yeah, you're not coming back.
Yeah, so that's an excuse for when you do all right.
No, I just didn't fit. So The thing for me, I wasn't like a naughty kid through school. I was probably best described as, I guess, mischievous, you know, a bit cheeky. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. Disruptive.
Well, no, actually, I say that, Mark. Like, through normal school, as it were, like GCSE, year 11, I was just not noticed because there were always kids a lot naughtier than me, you know, the ones that try and burn the school down and things. So I wasn't one of them. But then when it went to A-levels and I was sixth form, then all of a sudden I was like the naughty kid.
Found your feet.
Yeah, well, no.
But you lose the structure.
All the proper naughty kids had left. And then it was like...
The burden was passed
to you. That was it, yeah. So it had come down a few levels. And I just didn't fit into what the school wanted me to be through A-levels. They wanted us all to be like heads on. Yeah. I'd got it in my head, well, I'm choosing to be here now. So I can kind of... It was silly things. Like my old school would say, on your free periods, you're not allowed off the school grounds.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I choose to be here. I'll go where I want.
Yeah.
So like me and my best mate at the time go to the pub. And then we'd call, it was a free period. It was a couple of quick beers. Then we'd come back and get caught on camera and stuff like that. I think I picked up about four final warnings throughout the course of the year.
So you proper went for it then? Kept them wanting to get rid of you?
Well, I didn't think I did anything too bad, but evidently they disagreed.
So that was it? You was gone?
That was it. So, yeah, they said to me at that point, if you're going to carry it on, do it somewhere else. And I actually looked down and went, you know what, I don't want to be in academia anymore. I've had enough of it. I need to move on. I was adamant I wasn't going to pick up the family business.
Okay. You didn't want to follow on?
Didn't want to, no. It was never the intention at that age. So I went and did a year's worth of agency work. And I clocked that they paid you more if you did the heavy lifting jobs. So I took on all the heavy lifting agency work. And then at the end of that year, I went, you know what, it's pretty good to be a decorator. So I went back into it.
What, back with your old man?
No, well... Family stuff in the background. Right. Me and my old man had a big bust up. Right. So I actually, my granddad was like toning things down. So we sort of did a balance shift. So he was bringing it down. I picked it up. So I started working alongside him, took on all of his old customers.
Oh, nice.
And I came up as he went down as such. So he then ended up working for me. And yeah, that was the beginning.
So did you go straight into having your own business then?
Yeah.
So what... Like sole trader?
Self-employed sole trader, yeah. I took over the business, as it were, the family business at 17.
Kept that name?
No. So originally my grandfather was trading under his name.
Right.
RDP came about when I took it over. Right. So I wanted to, because I'd fallen out with my dad at the time and he was trading under his name, like my surname,
yeah.
It needed to be different because we were the same area and I didn't want to cross over. The RDP was born back then, which was...
But you took your granddad's clients, in effect.
Yeah. So he was toning it down, so heading towards retirement. He dropped down to like 3 days a week. I took over his clients when he got big jobs in and didn't want them.
Yeah.
Good timing then, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it was. It was really good for me, actually, to be honest, because I served like... I'd learned a lot working with my dad, and then working with my granddad, I got to work with him, which was, that time was valuable to me anyway, like working alongside my granddad, he was like my best mate.
I was going to say, I bet it's quite nice as well, it reflected working with your granddad.
Yeah, looking back now, I'm so grateful I had that.
Because not many people get that chance, do they?
No. And it was probably 4 or 5 years of pretty much full time, and that time was invaluable.
Yeah.
But I served almost like a second apprenticeship then with him on the tools.
Yeah.
Because I was only 17 when I took the business over, I had a bit of a complex thinking, I'm that young, everyone's going to look at me, 17-year-old kid, and think, we're not giving you
anywhere.
You're
going around to quote for jobs. And...
Yeah, exactly. So I did a City and Guilds and got the qualification just so I could turn around and go, I'm qualified.
Bit of paper,
and I never showed it to anyone ever. Nobody ever asked
did
me
you ever passing. Did you ever have that record of achievement at school,
the NRA?
Yeah, did you have it? Did you ever get it? Was like a red folder, weren't it? That all through school. So I finished school in 92. So you got this record of achievement book and the school drummed it into you, put all your certificates in it.
Yeah.
When you go for a job, you take that. I remember the very first job I had, the first apprenticeship I went for, straight from school, I remember walking into to see the guy with this book, this national record of achievement, handed it to him and he went, just put it on the, didn't even open it, just put it on the desk and went, right, tell us about yourself.
Do you know what, when you're in school, they make you believe like that is going to be like the Bible. Yeah. This is going to be so important.
Yeah, and it was just a complete waste of time.
Never showed it to anyone. Yeah. I don't think I've ever shown my GCSE results to anyone.
Me neither.
People take you on your face value, don't they? A lot of the time.
Yeah, I think if you're employing someone or something like that, you're taking the characteristics rather than what's written down on a piece of paper.
Especially now with the likes of the social media and like you were saying, Russ, your portfolio is there for everyone to see.
I mean, it was different when I started up. So when I started, social media wasn't a thing. And the most prestigious thing you could do was be in the Yellow Pages, ironically. Yeah. So it was different, but I was very fortunate that I had my grandfather with me. And that probably, looking back, weighted out. If anyone was a bit unsure that this young lad was turning up, a lot of the time I was turning up with my granddad, who was, you know, in his 60s at the time, I think. So,
and did you find they always spoke to him before you?
Yeah. I was happy with that, mate, at the time.
Okay. You're still learning ropes, aren't you? You're still getting to grips with it.
Absolutely.
And seeing how he's going to price stuff and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness to my granddad, he would actually sort of turn around and go, oh, don't ask me, ask him, he's the boss.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so he would try to bring me into it.
Yeah. That's good news than that.
So that was my sort of, my journey into the trade. It was kind of like always there. I mean, as I say, I grew up around it. So
you were 17, 18.
17 took the business on, and then over the years I've worked in pretty much every demographic of the painting and decorating industry there is. So I've done, you know, I've done the council work, I've done pub refurbs, I've had lads on, I've worked on my own. At the moment now we specialise in high-end domestic, so really fortunate, a lot of our customers are, you know, multi-million pound houses and high-end finishing.
It's like you do your years of like the council work and the it's not the lower jobs at all, because that's the wrong way of putting it, but you cut your teeth on those jobs and then now the reward for that is getting your high-end clients. It'll be the same.
It's like with any trade, you've got to work basically
to build that clientele up.
You can siphon it through and then get your quality clients.
Definitely.
To be honest, I like you said, Mark, like those jobs are vital. I see it like a pyramid myself. So there's like a lot of the lower end work, like your council work, stuff like that. There's a lot of it going. But depending on what you're doing with your business, it's a lot easier to scale up a business doing things like insurance work, council work, because you can get lads on.
You know the money's there, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And you're just dealing with margins. So I've done that. What, in honesty, I've found difficulty in is scaling up the business in the high-end domestic market.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because getting lads...
Because you feel like there's a ceiling point to it.
It's more... A lot of the houses we're working in, the customers are extremely fussy, and rightly so. You know, they're paying good money and they've got beautiful houses. But finding lads that I can bring into the team that will work to those standards, that's really difficult.
Yeah.
It's classic. Even in my industry, you get guys who are qualified, but they will never work as hard as you want to work.
Yeah.
So you're always struggling to get somebody to do the job as quality as you would.
They always say, don't they?
So you'd always have that problem.
Yeah, they say whoever you employ will only work at 80% of how you would work.
Yeah.
Because it's not their business. They're not...
It's not their problem.
Yeah, it's not. They go home at night and
that's it. Yeah.
And they do their bit, whereas you're the one stressing and...
I've seen it firsthand. I've got lads that I've used as subbies in the past that I know are good on their own rights, and I've heard all the good reports. I've seen their work's great. You get them subby for you, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, what's going on? Where's that bloke gone?
So the
high-end domestic market, I enjoy it. It gives me the job satisfaction, you know, because you're doing these transformations and you're finishing everything to a really high standard. It's great. You can walk away at the end of the job and you're proud of your work.
Yeah.
But building a business in that, I still haven't worked out how to do that, to be honest.
So you've gone from having your granddad, and then there would have come a point where your granddad stepped away from it.
Yeah.
So you've gone on your own then from, what, early 20s, I suppose?
There were probably times where I was on my own in amongst it.
Yeah.
Where my granddad, he retired on me 3 times.
Well,
it wasn't me pulling him out, it was him. He would ring me up, so he'd retire on me, spend a few months with my nan, bless her, and he would do stuff like, he rung me the once, I remember the conversation, he just rung me up, he went, Ross, you busy at the minute? I was like, yeah, I'm always busy. He went, you reckon you could find 3 days a week for me? I'm like, yeah, of course I could, I can find that. Because to be fair, he was a bloody good decorator as well. Yeah. So I was always glad when he wanted to jump back on. I said, well, I thought you were retired, you know, you and me nan were going off to Spain and doing all this. He went, Ross, I'm doing my shopping, your mum's shopping, and your aunt's shopping.
Yeah.
He said, I'm going to Morrison's three times a week. It's
I need
killing
a break.
Me. Yeah, he was like, yeah. It's killing me. He said, if I'm going to do that, I'd rather go and earn, you know, earn some pocket money and have another couple of holidays. So he was, he always wanted to stay busy. So he wasn't a sit around, do nothing kind of guy. He retired on me three times, came back out, and then eventually completely retired. I'd say he was probably in the business with me for 3-4 years.
Right.
And then I completely, I guess, took the reins by, 21, 22.
So you're on your own at 21, 22.
Mm.
And is the path then on your own and building it, or was there anything?
I mean, it's been each and every way. Right. So I've had times where I've never gone huge. The most lads I've had on has been 6.
Right.
So that's like a team of 7, as it were. But we've dipped in and out of different demographics of work. So I've done insurance contracting where we were working national. So we were approved contractors for a few insurance firms. So we'd work everywhere from the Lake District down to the bottom of Cornwall.
Actually, travel with it then?
Yeah, we used to.
Because find a lot of decorators stay sort of pretty local. I know a few that travel, but majority seem to be. It's like myself, I stay really local in my work.
I guess I get a bit restless. So with me, although I love the trade, the thing that keeps me interested is running a business. So with that, I've dabbled. So right. I'm like, okay, we'll try this. I'll see where the profit lines are on that. So with the national work, the insurance work, it was well paid.
Yeah.
And I was taking lads and we'd go and do a couple of weeks on a job in Plymouth or wherever it might be, just to work out what was working.
So have you looked at stuff and gone, we can carry on just doing the painting, or have you gone, right, we can get into that more niche-y, more wallpaper work, or, you know, and gone, right, let's try and go down that avenue a little bit more.
I think that's probably where I am now.
Oh, are you?
Probably where I am now. So we do stuff like HVLP spray finishing, so bespoke cabinetry, things like that. We'll do on-site spray finishing, we'll do high-end and specialist wallpaper hanging,
right.
Work for a few interior designers. So again, you get the higher-end, more niche materials to work with. I think that's probably where we're at these days.
Ladies and gents, just a quick one to say a huge thank you to our new headline sponsor, CT1, the best sealants on the market, voted for by the British public. Not only that, it's made in Britain as well. So go and support a product and a brand that is made in the UK. But I just want to say to you, they've got a brand new product out, which is the BT1. It's a combination sealant and adhesive like the popular CT1, but it's perfect for keeping a hygienic environment. And it's designed to completely stop the growth of bacteria, microbes, and fungus. And not only that, this stuff is strong. Now, it's going to be available at Travis Perkins, Wicks, Jewson's, and pretty much everywhere else. So there's no excuse not to go and give it a go. So we're really happy to be partnering with CT1.
So you said, we were just chatting before we come in here, and there was a point within that decorating period where you stepped away from it.
There was indeed.
So just to sort of touch on that then.
Yeah, so the background of that. So I've been in the trades, as I say, pretty much all my life. I think I was 24. I got to the point where I got my young son, young family on the go, wanted to buy a house. Being self-employed, bank didn't want to touch me.
Yeah.
They would give me a mortgage at the time, but it was like enough to buy a...
Was that the time when they were doing... self-cert mortgages, weren't they?
Unfortunately not, mate.
Was it after
It was after. Yeah, it was after the crash.
Yeah, because they were doing the self-cert. Literally, you'd go, as a self-employed, I earn $300,000 a year.
Yeah, no.
Give you what you want. And then you go, shit, I can't afford a thing. Yeah.
Do you know what, though, Mark? I built the business over a number of years to get a mortgage. So I'd got good figures in front of me. I can't remember. It wasn't huge at the time. It might have been, I don't know, maybe $45,000, something like that. That I'd turn around to the bank and I had a profit line. And the bank literally looked at it and they went, yeah, okay, we can give you a mortgage, but the mortgage they'd give me was enough to buy like a 1-bed flat.
Yeah.
And I was looking, I needed like at least a 3-bed. So I looked at my options and my ex-wife at the time saw an advert in the paper that said there was a particular job that was advertised with on-target earnings of $65,000 a year plus within 3 months of training.
Right. But at this point, you're running your decorating firm.
Yep.
It's doing all right.
Yeah.
You're specifically putting money into it because you know you want your mortgage.
Yep. Bank didn't want it.
They didn't want it. So your missus has spotted this thing. All right. Okay.
Yeah. So we've got like an offer of $65,000 a year on the table here. So I've looked at this job advert and thought, right, okay, what we got here? Bailiff. So I'm like, right. And at the time, the thing that was said to me, she went, you'd be good at that. You don't like people. Smashing.
Absolute perfect.
But I've looked at the job advert, and I think it would, the training wage was about 25 grand. And then after that, it was on target earnings of like 60, 65 grand a year.
Yeah.
So I've looked and thought, well, I can do this. Give it a shot. I'll do the training. If the money's there to be had, fantastic. I can do, I think the bank at the time wanted 3 pay slips.
Yeah.
So I've got in my head, I can go out there.
3 months?
Yeah, 3 months training and 3 months on the job. So I'm thinking 6 months I can quit.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll give myself a year because I might not be great at it to begin with. 4 years later, I was still doing the job.
So what happened to the decorating business? Did you just fold it in?
I stopped it at the time. My dad was still trading at that point, so he was still decorating, but I literally, I just stopped.
Right.
My focus was on getting a house, and within, I think, 7 months of starting the job, I'd got the mortgage offer. In fact, they didn't just give me the mortgage offer, they wanted to give me more than I wanted.
At the same bank?
At the same bank.
Was it but the, with best the same
bit,
guy?
The best bit though, Mark, I said to Nathan about this earlier, the same bank, and the ironic thing was the wage there, the basic, the only guaranteed money was 17 grand a year. The rest was all commission-based.
From what money you're getting off people?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So they're giving you a mortgage on 17 grand?
Yeah, 17 grand. And then, but because I turned up with 3 pay slips that said I'd earned whatever it was, I'd earned those months. So like, oh yeah, brilliant. No.
That's the difference because, between employed and self-employed, isn't
it? It's huge, isn't it?
Safety net that you think you've got.
But they got a reference from the employer and couldn't give me the mortgage fast enough. And I kind of thought, well, I was more secure decorating, to be honest, because if you missed the target system that the company had, you just got your 17 grand a year basic. That was it. So you might have took home 1,400 quid a month.
So if that company's coming to you and going, right, we need you to go and get 10 grand off that guy, for argument's sake, what sort of money will you get from that?
So what I did, I was a court certificated bailiff, so it was all very official. We were enforcing warrants on behalf of local authorities. Now, the way that worked, so it's very different to being a debt collector. There's a mountain of difference between the two. With being a court certificated bailiff, the money that somebody owes the local authority remains the same. So that money needs to go to the local authority. You don't get a cut of that.
Right.
What you... The bonus system that it used to work on was you would get a percentage of the collected fees. So the fees that the bailiff company collects, you got a percentage of that.
Got you.
But you might collect, you could collect, say, £2,000 worth of fees in a day, and then you would get 20% of that plus your basic. So, you know, some days you can be earning 500-600 quid a day doing that.
Yeah. But then other times when they're chucking some big jobs at you, But then you've got to go to, I'm sure if your man's not weighing you in for 10, 20 grand, it's not just like the odd council tax he's missed. There's a bit of a story behind
it. There was all sorts, mate. Yeah, I mean, we collected anything from a couple hundred quid to a couple of hundred thousand, depending on what was owed. It was very, very different. The majority of what we did was business rates. So, like, the disparity there, you could be, as I said before, you could be turning up to a big organisation. I won't name any because they'll probably sue me. But I dealt with some big, reputable organisations that you'd never assume that a bailiff was coming. And the reason that happens in that industry is you'd have, I don't know, we use one for example, not that I ever dealt with these people, but you'd have, say, Tesco's, right? And then you'd end up turning up at their head office because they'd owe money on empty rates. The way that they work is if they've got, say, a Tesco Express in a little town and another unit comes up that somebody else, like Sainsbury's, could go into, they'll buy that building just to stop anyone else using it.
Yeah.
And then they'll just let it sit. So it'll sit empty. And you get empty rate relief for a certain amount of years, then that expires, and a lot of the time that's when it slips the net.
Oh, yeah.
So you'd end up turning up for an empty building. Yeah. It's never a problem, you always got paid. The flip side of that is you could be turning up at a scrapyard in Birmingham that are going to set the dogs on you.
Yeah.
Like, personally, I used to hate scrapyards and gyms. Guaranteed grief.
There's usually some big guys knocking
around.
Oh,
yeah,
mate.
Big time. Yeah. Guaranteed grief.
So did you get much grief doing it?
Yeah. I mean, I did it for 4 years, so weeks and months could go by when nothing would happen, and then you'd have a week of madness. I mean, if I tell you everything that happened, it sounds horrific, but it was over 4 years.
Right.
So if you imagine every day you go into work, 5 days a week, and you might be knocking on 15 different premises a day. But when it kicked off, it tended to really kick off. Yeah. You know, on one occasion, I actually got escorted out of the county by the police because of the people I'd upset.
Really?
Yeah.
They just got you straight out.
Yeah, as soon as I say bailiff, I say they got the umpire.
There's that stigma in there. As soon as the bailiffs are coming for so and so, straight away they've invested in what the hell's going on.
And obviously, if you've got a bailiff at your own personal door, you're like, oh, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, and you don't want them there, so you're trying to shush them down, and you don't. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a high pressure. A lot of the reactions, you can completely understand why people reacted the way that they did. But over the course of the time that I did it, I mean, I got ran over twice. I had knives pulled on me, a gun pointed at me. Trying to think what else happened there. Petrol poured on me. I was threatened to be set alight. Got locked in several buildings because, you know, they'd be like, right, well, you're not taking anything, I'll lock you in.
No worries.
All sorts of things happened over the time.
Just to get that mortgage.
Just to get that mortgage, mate. It's mad. That's the crazy thing. I was saying this before. It was when I was in the job, it was like intoxicating. I don't know whether it was the adrenaline or the. You know, I made some really good friends doing the job. They're still good friends now.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like this toxic boys' club where we'd compare war stories. Like, oh, you got run over today. Oh, this geezer tried to stab me. And it was mad. Looking as soon as I got out of it. I mean, plus. I was 24 to 28.
Yeah, so invincible.
I thought I was invincible.
Yeah. Seems fun at the time.
I was a young lad, and it was this lifestyle where I was working all over the country.
As a bailiff, it carries a little bit of stigma, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it does. Look, let's be honest. Most people's impression, you say the word bailiff, the first thing people think of is a single mother with a crying baby.
Yeah.
And you're taking all their stuff, or you're kicking them out. That just isn't what happens. Yeah. It's with the work that we did, particularly that sort of demographic of people, as I say, that they were actually generally, if you're on benefits, you're not paying all those things that we were collecting. So that never happened.
Yeah.
But you would turn up at, I think the best way I ever had it described to me was it was sorting out the can't pays from the won't pays. I mean, if somebody can't pay, there's literally nothing you could do. And we used to walk away all the time.
When you see they've got nothing.
There's nothing you can do. Yeah, absolutely nothing. If somebody says, look, this has happened. I've had a business. It's gone completely wrong. I've gone bankrupt. I've got nothing. You pretty much just go, all right, mate, no worries. And you write a report, send it back to the local authority. And they wouldn't want you to know it, but it gets written off.
Yeah. You can't take a percentage of nothing, can you?
They can't spend the money pursuing it. So
exactly. On the other hand, legitimately, I turned up at houses that were saying they couldn't pay, and there's a Rolls Royce on the drive.
Yeah.
So it's like,
some of those people, I suppose, are they can pay, and they just wait and wait and wait until they get the final letter, and the bailiff at the door. Yeah. They're like, all right, okay, here you go.
Well, we talked about this earlier where I dealt with a fella who used to use it as a very low interest loan.
So, that's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, so he would get about £100,000 worth of business rates and wait until the bailiff turned up, because to him, he was then paying £500, maybe £700 max of bailiff fees. That was it. That was like a 6-month loan on £100,000, and it cost him £700.
Yeah. You take that
system, aren't you?
Yeah,
But
like you say, when you turned up for that money, he strung it out that far.
Yeah. Oh, he paid it with a smile on his face. So I've done him a
favor. This is the very last one, and he's like, yeah, there you go, Russ.
Yeah,
I've done.
Yeah.
You've just saved me a load of money.
That's it. Yeah. So there are people, and I mean, you know, limited companies. There were a lot of people that knew how to manipulate the system.
Yeah.
But when you're doing it, when you're in that job, you just get to know it. I learned the legalities inside out. And it is just a numbers game to you as well, because you're on this commission, there's pressure on you. You've got to, you know, to me, rightly or wrongly, at the time I did the job, I was like, this is dog eat dog.
Yeah.
So I've got my family. I need to put money on the table for them, or put a house on the table for them at the time. And
What was your missus saying at the time? Did she like you doing it, or did she
want
you?
Did she
want you out?
She, to be honest with you, mate, didn't give a
flying
one. Yeah, I'm remarried now. My wife now, there's no chance she'd let me do it. No chance at all. My ex-wife, I'd walk in and I'd be like, she'd be like, oh, do you have a good day? I was like, yeah, I got run over today. She'd be like, well, what bonus bracket are we in?
Right, okay, so, yeah.
You know, it was like, how much are you bringing back this month?
Yeah. So, yeah. So you've done that then, you got your house, you got your mortgage, and then after, 4 years, you stepped back into...
Yeah, so I stayed in that job too long. I stayed in it too long because of the money. It was...
Yeah, it's safety net, isn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. And then what I did, so I had a little bit of a change within the industry. So I went from collecting magistrates' fines to... Sorry, from collecting civil fines to collecting magistrates, and that was just a whole different ball game.
Really?
And that was enough to get me out of it. Yeah. I had a few really close calls.
Yeah.
Where I thought, you know what, I've rode my luck now. So you
know, 9 lives are running out.
Yeah, and to be fair, there were a couple of lads within the industry that I know that did get seriously hurt doing the job. Life changing injuries and stuff like that. I'd run the tightrope enough.
So do you think doing that job helps lead on to what you're doing now? We'll come to that in a minute, but you know, just bear that in mind then when we get to the podcast. So you come out of the bailiff side of stuff and you've gone straight back into decorating then?
Straight back in, yeah, I remember.
And fired the company back up?
Do you know what? I know it wouldn't be for everyone, but it was so easy. Right. I remember making the decision, I'm done with this now. That's enough. I'd had the wake-up calls and all the rest of it. And I went round one day, and again, I mean, this was a few years ago, so I printed off a letter, and I went round all of my old customers, like my good customers that used to give me decent-sized work, dropped a letter off, and within 2 days, I'd got 6 weeks' worth of work.
Right. Wow.
So that was it. Jumped straight back in, put word out that I was back in the trade, and, yeah, pick straight back up, fortunately.
Nice. So to be able to go straight back into that, Was there that concern, you know, we're coming from the security of the job to going back self-employed, how is it going to work out again?
If I'm honest, no.
You knew it would.
I knew it would, but I've always grown up around it.
That's confidence in your work,
isn't it? It is, but also I've never really had job security in terms of, even though doing that, being a bailiff, I was working for a company, it was all performance related, right, so there was never security.
So it's always on you anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So I've always had that. So no, I thought as long as I can get that initial period of work to get work back in and jump, then I knew I'd be all right. Yeah.
So then you're back into it.
So then I'm back into it. So yeah, about 28, back into business and back on the hamster wheel, as it were. So
just pushing the brush about.
Yeah.
Doing a bit. Yeah, so is it just on your own now, or you got lads with you?
At the moment, I've got one subby on.
Right, okay. Yeah, do you like it like that?
Do you know what?
Is it easy to sleep at night trying to get...
It is.
Yeah, I don't know. Have you got any guys,
working
with you?
Yeah, I used to.
So it's always that...
Yeah, it's just that, make sure you've got enough for the next day.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got this guy who's coming to work, you've got to make... You worry about them more than yourself.
Mm.
Definitely.
And you're constantly thinking, I've got enough work for them, I've got enough work for them.
But that can get into your head, and you're like, you're then more concerned about getting other people's work in before yours.
Yeah.
This is why I've always worked on my own, always been a sole trader. People say to me, would you not take people on? I went, I don't want to build my business that big. I'm happy with where it is. Having the stress of having two or three blokes trying to sort their work out and get working for them would really play on me.
But you're not a plumber, you're a manager.
Yeah,
true.
So, that's not what do you know you what? Want
to do. So I think it was 2020, just before COVID and all that sort of hit the fan. I'd got back up to five. There were five lads on, so it was me plus five. So there was six of us, and we were pretty much working in three teams of two. COVID hit. Obviously, everything went to part. Now, I worked all the way through because my wife's business is a salon. So that just got absolutely decimated. Yeah. So the pressure was on me that I had to cover everything. So I worked, if anything, I worked more.
I think a lot of trades did, didn't they?
Yeah, but...
Did you have any time off at all?
None.
I remember when it first hit really hard, that first week, maybe a week after, because it was red hot.
Yeah.
I had that week and a bit off, and then the builder went, you know, we're doing a big job, you can go on the top floor on your own.
I was flat out.
There was a point.
Yeah, a lot of people are like that.
There was one point where they shut the trade centres.
Yeah.
For paint anyway, I don't know about everything else, but they shut the trade centres. However, a friend of mine works in the insurance industry, so he was classed as essential because he was doing fire and flood repair.
Yeah.
So he was like, that's fine, mate, just use my account.
Yeah.
So I worked all the way through. Now, a few of the lads that I had on didn't, for their own reasons, like one was at risk and stuff like that. And what it meant was I dropped the team down from six down to three, I think, initially. But that was a wake-up call for me because I'd gone from having six on. And if I'm honest, I was doing 14-hour days. The money was good. I had no quality of life. I was just always at work because it's not just the pressure of the work. It's the pressure of, like you touched on, like bringing the work in. And when you've got five lads, that's a lot of work. You know, I mean, we've decorated some huge houses and the customers will say, like, oh, how many lads can you bring in? And I'll go, look, we will flood that. If I bring six of us in, we'll flood the house. You won't be able to live in it because you take over an entire
room.
You're
in every room and everywhere.
Yeah. So even with gigantic houses, like a team of three or four can eat through that really, really quickly. So when I had six on, I was having to go out and price and quote so much work to keep everybody busy. Like I said, the bank loved it, as it were. But me personally, it took stepping away from it to go to take that breath. And go, oh, bloody hell, what was I doing?
Yeah.
So ever since coming out the back of that, haven't ramped it back up.
Yeah.
Last year, there were three of us. At the moment, there's two.
And you're happy now in that?
Yeah, yeah.
It's
manageable.
I think COVID did that to a lot of people.
It made them reset their quality of life,
didn't it? You know, just people were working flat out before.
Yeah.
Makes you look at your values.
COVID come along and you think, actually, I don't need to work like this
to
actually have a decent living.
Yeah.
And so people are now just...
Do you know what? I was no better off for it. Like I was earning a lot more money, but I was also spending it. I mean, at the time, I was living in Worcester, so we were right in the city as well. And we were living in a house, and I kid you not, I don't think we used the kitchen in 7 months. It was like you could get Deliveroo everything.
Yeah.
So we could get Miller and Carter on Deliveroo.
Dropped off.
It was horrific, Mark, honestly. Yeah. I looked at my bank account once, and I thought, I'm spending so
people
much
were hemorrhaging. I found that during that time, being a plumber, we were classed as essential workers, so we could go and do a bit. And you'd go to someone's house, and they'd go, "Oh, how are you doing?" I'd always start with, "Yeah, I'm all right," because you'd have to gauge where they are. They could be on their absolute arse. It's really it, or they're flying. There was no middle ground. I found in that time.
No.
People were either really on it.
Changed a lot of lives.
Oh, massively. And like what you said, Sam, was people's life model changed, didn't it?
Mm.
And you went, I don't need that. I don't need that.
Yeah.
And it got to that point where people were...
It makes you reset.
Yeah.
Massively. Yeah.
That's what it did for me. I'm glad it did. Because if it didn't, looking back, I'd have burnt out.
Yeah.
But it just hit... It stopped for me. And I think there was probably maybe 2-3 weeks where there was this, I was still working, but there was this big shuffle where initially nobody really knew how bad it was. You know, are we all going to die? But straight away I had a couple of customers go, I've got an empty house. So I was like, okay, I'll work and I'll work on my own. And there was probably a 3-week period where it was just me working in completely empty houses. And that did give me enough mental headspace to look and go, Jesus Christ, like, isn't it nice to go home at like 4:30 and actually go home?
Are you wasting time? I think that some of you probably are, and I have a solution for you. Nobody wants to do any type of admin. Now, I have a solution for you, and it is called Tradeify. It's a fully automated job scheduling, invoicing, and quoting all in one place. Now, that software is going to save you 12 hours a week, and all by using a simple software solution. Now, you can try it for 2 weeks absolutely free, no cards needed, and you'll even get support in person from Tradeify themselves. Now, when you're done, you can always come back to me and thank me, but just enjoy the extra 12 hours that you're going to gain from just using the software.
So it made your mental headspace that little bit better. So is that, do you think that was a part of a catalyst into what you do now? Because obviously now you've set up in the last, it's quite recently, isn't it? In the last couple of months?
Yeah, about 7 weeks ago.
That's 7 weeks. Yeah. You set up a podcast, the Talking Tradesman podcast.
I have indeed, yeah.
And it's not predominantly mental health, is it?
No. So the reasons I set the podcast up was to raise awareness of mental health in the construction industry, essentially, and do that because mental health, it's such a big puzzle. There's so many elements to it. The reason I set the podcast up is a bit of a long-winded story, but to condense that down, a few years ago, I started studying psychology. So I started doing a BSc honours degree at Open Uni. And then through doing the degree, you have to kind of pick a direction. And I picked to go like down the counselling direction. So I've started studying psychology, counselling, and then through the counselling, started volunteering at Samaritans. So I've been doing that for over a year now. And for me, it was all these various pieces coming together where I was seeing firsthand, and also, you know, I know three lads in the last 2 years who were all in the trades who have taken their own lives.
Right.
And then also working at Samaritans and answering the phone, you know, speaking to so many blokes that are tradesmen. And all these things are sort of like, you know, there's like light bulbs going off. Going, there's a problem here.
Yeah.
Now, I knew there was a problem, but once I started looking into the statistics and the figures, then it was like, actually, this isn't a problem. This is like a crisis.
Yeah. Scary. So scary. Oh,
it is, mate. Numbers. I mean, yeah, those statistics. So for everyone that takes their own, out of anyone that takes their own life, 75% of that is men in general. Now, it's the biggest killer of men under 50. And also, amongst those figures, if you're in the building trades, you are 4 times more likely to take your own life as a man than being in another industry. So by being male, you're 3 times more likely. By being in the trades, you're 7 times more likely
yeah.
to take your own life. The worst affected trades are painters, decorators and plasterers.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Which are the finishing trades. So my personal hypothesis on it is it's to do with working in isolation, amongst other things. So I was looking at all these statistics and thinking, what can be done, basically? And through working at Samaritans, I realised the power of a conversation, the power of just listening, essentially. And yeah, after a conversation with my wife of, you know, what could I do, bring these skills together, the knowledge, the experience, it was, you know, maybe I should set a podcast up and have that and get people from and around the building trades to come on, talk about their stories, their journeys, get some mental health professionals in as well so we can offer tips and advice on how to handle some of the things that we have to go through. And it's been a huge response, to be fair.
Because you sort of went straight in it both feet first,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, jumped in. I've got to credit my wife for that one.
Because
yeah.
I had a quick flick for your Instagram and I looked and it's like, from one of the views, it looks like you're in like a little room.
Yeah.
But then when I scroll further down, you've got like an office space, haven't you?
Yeah, it is.
You've
yeah.
just gone and...
Yeah, so
we're
story,
not going to do it in a spare bedroom at home. We're just going to go and rent an office
it.
Space. And,
yeah. Well, I believe in doing things properly. If you're going to do it, like jump in and give it everything that you've got straight off the bat. I think if we'd have started in a little room, maybe it wouldn't have progressed. I had the initial conversation with my wife about, you know, maybe it's a good idea to do a podcast. And she then started looking at office space around the local area, reached out to me and said, look, I've got an appointment on Tuesday to go and see this office that's available. It's only 10 minutes from our house.
Is it big? Right. Is it a big space?
No.
Is it not?
It's probably maybe half of this size,
right, okay.
half of this size of room. So it's a small office.
Yeah.
I wasn't available. I was at work. So I said, look, go and view the space. Drop me a message. Send me some pictures. We'll talk about it this evening. I just got a message back saying, don't need to send the pictures. I've signed the tenancy. So we've now got 12 months. And then it was, when can you do the refurb? I'm like, what do you mean the refurb kind of thing?
Yeah, what have you signed this
yeah,
up for?
Yeah, exactly. So my initial response was, not this side of Christmas. I'm stacked.
And she of went, course, yeah. What do we, I forget Christmas yeah. is...
And
yeah,
she
yeah,
went,
about
well, we'll have paid a month's rent by then.
Yeah.
So ended up refurbing our office into a little humble studio over the course of maybe about 3 weeks worth of evenings. And yeah, the Talking Tradesman was born.
Nice. But sometimes throwing yourself in it like that makes you make it work.
There wasn't room to hesitate.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was. And
you'd have probably talked yourself out of it.
100% I would.
Yeah. Overthinking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't you? People can overthink and then
just stress yourself doing nothing.
Yeah. You never do anything.
Rather than just doing it and then making
but
it success.
What I would say is the response, the outreach from it has been huge.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of messages publicly and privately from people that have listened to some of the conversations and resonated with some of the topics of conversation. And it's really made a difference. You know, I won't go into detail because some of them were private messages,
yeah.
but there are people that needed help that have now sought it after listening. I mean, one of the episodes that I actually had the branch director of Samaritans come on and talk discuss the service, because again, I think Samaritans is a really underutilized service for tradespeople.
Yeah.
Fantastic service. I mean, I could talk about that for ages, to be fair, mate. It depends how long you got. but it's a great service. It's completely anonymous, which rings a good bell for tradespeople, because there's that stigma, isn't there? The men, you know, big strong men. Yeah. We can't. Yeah. And sometimes talking to a stranger over the phone who they don't know you, you don't know them, you can actually be honest and real.
They've got no preconceived notion or anything like that.
It sometimes be even less than that. Like, I had a friend who had a stroke and he couldn't talk.
Yeah.
But even just being there without saying anything is more helpful than actually spending hours talking to each other.
Yeah.
Just having, especially with the decorators, you're talking about isolation. Even just having another person in a room decorating with them is enough to keep them
Even if you don't say anything, it's just
another guy, another the presence of someone.
There's definitely a difference. I mean, my wife will say to me, she can see the difference in me when I'm working solo compared to when I've got lads with me. Because she, according to her, my anxiety goes up. I become more anxious. I'm an overthinker anyway.
Yeah.
So if you stick me in a room for 8 hours on my own, you know.
So you couldn't do one of these solitary confinement sort of challenges where people go, right, if you can survive 21 days in here.
Well, think about it another way. Like the prison service, for example, put people in isolation as a punishment.
Mm.
People used to use it against prisoners of war in wartime as a punishment, as a torture, isolation. Yet we choose to do it to ourselves a lot of the time.
It's a mad thing. The mind is, it can really...
But there really is an issue. There's a huge disparity of people that are affected that are particularly in the building trades versus any other industry. And my aim with a podcast is just to raise that awareness, get people talking about it. I mean, the catchphrase is let's talk, which is literally, you know, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Let's get word out there that there's this issue, because I thought about it and I think, well, if suicide is the biggest killer of men under 50, yet there's no governmental action or anything going on to address that. Now, if the biggest killer of men under 50 was cycling, you'd have to think that there would be something being done.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That there'd be national movements to increase safety of cycling, or if it was fishing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It seems to be because it's people taking their own lives, and it's a horrible subject. It's a taboo subject. People don't like to talk about it. And a lot of people don't like to listen about it either.
Yeah, I think people find it hard to listen, don't they?
But what would you make you think the reason for people being under 50 taking this out? Own lives. What would you say your number one thing for that?
The first point to make on that, and a good point to make, is that it doesn't drop off after 50.
Yeah.
So the rates remain pretty similar. Unfortunately, other things just catch up. So you've got other comorbidities that then start to come into play. It's just essentially, it's the biggest killer of men under 50, because the comorbidities aren't there. These are the conversations I'm trying to have. I don't have the answer because...
But it's the journey in trying to find the answer. I don't think you'll ever find the answers. Well, it's that.
Finding the main reason why people would do that.
You would hope that if there was an answer, something would be done to stop it. I mean, there's triggers. There's common triggers. Relationship breakdowns is a big trigger. Addiction is a big trigger. So there are lots of common things. But as with mental health, there's this huge puzzle where, you know, what's a pressure for one person is not for somebody else. So there's a lot of different topics to cover within the whole mental health spectrum.
Yeah. But what we'll do, we'll get Jack to add in all the links to your podcast and that.
I appreciate that, man.
You know, if anyone is watching this, listening to this and wants to drop a comment in the comments afterwards about, you know, hooking up with Russell about
the definitely podcast. I'm always looking for anyone. What I'm trying to do is provide a platform for people to come and talk about their stories, their journeys, whatever that might be, positive and negative. Then the platform's now there. We've got, I think, 10 episodes out already. Some fantastic episodes, getting some great feedback. And
you've got some good ones coming up as well.
There's some lads with some really deep stories mixed in with some, like I say, some professionals. So I've had a PT on to talk about physical health, you know, which obviously blends into mental health. I've had one of the Samaritans on. I've got a CBT therapist lined up to come on. I've got a lady to come on to talk about, as I was saying before, talking about the menopause. There's a whole host of not only just people's stories, but also trying to piece together and you know, bring a picture as to why this is all happening.
What you're doing is mega. It's always good to to get it out there, isn't it?
I think it's just a case of trying to move the needle, Mark, you know, move the needle in the right direction, get people talking.
Yeah.